From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Republican leaders are promising to fast-track the plan they released yesterday to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Committee votes are expected as early as tomorrow on the American Health Care Act, as the GOP plan is officially called. This morning, co-author Texas Congressman Kevin Brady was asked if it would cover more Americans than Obamacare.
I believe we're increasing access to affordable care for those who want it. And I think that's an important distinction here.
So what's actually in the Republican plan and how will it affect Americans if it becomes law? Joining us now is Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Hi, Julie.
Hey, Jeremy.
So if this bill passes, there would be no more mandate. That's what we've heard so far, that Americans have health insurance and no more tax penalty if they don't. But there would be increased insurance rates if they let their insurance lapse. Explain that.
Well, first of all, we should say that actually technically the mandate will remain in place because they can't repeal that under the special budget rules that they're using. But what they're repealing is the enforcement. So there wouldn't be any penalty in that case. Instead, the incentive they're going to have for people to have coverage and keep it is to say that if you don't maintain continuous coverage, meaning if you have a break in coverage of more than 63 days, you'd have to pay 30% more for your insurance for a year. Now, there are some people who complain that, well, that will just totally deter healthy people from getting on, because if they don't need it, why would they then buy it and pay 30% more?
So in the end, does the mandate cost more for people or does this new idea cost more for people?
I think it will depend on who they are and what their tax bracket is. But this is the Republicans' idea for trying to keep the provisions in place that would require insurers to sell to people who have pre-existing health conditions.
Now, this plan also calls for an end to Obamacare subsidies to help people buy health insurance. Republicans want to put in place a system of tax credits. How would that work?
Well, actually, the Obamacare subsidies mostly are tax credits. They're just a different kind of tax credits. They'll be based on different things. The ACA tax credits are based on people's incomes and the cost of insurance where they live. The new tax credits would be based mostly on age. Younger people would get smaller tax credits because insurance is cheaper if you're younger. Older people would get larger tax credits. But it's interesting, older people would get tax credits that are twice as large as younger people. But in this new proposal, they would let insurers charge older people five times as much as younger people. So even though older people would get bigger tax credits, they might not go as far.
What happens in this plan when it comes to coverage of contraception?
Well, one of the things that the plan would do, as the Republicans keep promising, is defund Planned Parenthood only for a year. And then, of course, they don't name Planned Parenthood, but they say that no organization that provides abortions, which Planned Parenthood does, and none of this money has ever been allowed to go for abortion. They would give that money instead to community health centers. They also strengthen the rules on not being able to use the tax credits to buy policies that cover abortion. I'm not entirely sure what they do about the contraceptive requirements. I'm pretty sure those are things that they can't touch, again, because of these special budget rules that they're using.
Hmm. Now, Julie, for people who get their health insurance through their employer and didn't see much of a change under Obamacare, will they see any change now or will things continue as they have?
Well, they won't see that much of a change. There's some limits that were put on by the Affordable Care Act to try and raise some money to help pay for the tax credits and subsidies. And some of those will be taken off, like how much money you can put away in a flexible spending account that lets you use pre-tax money for medical expenses. Once again, you'll be able to use that account to pay for over-the-counter drugs. There was a proposal early on that would have capped how much employers could provide in health insurance to their workers and not have that taxed. That got an enormous amount of pushback, and it was dropped towards the last minute.
And what about the issue of Medicaid funding and Medicaid expansion? Greg Walden, one of the co-authors, a congressman from Oregon, said, "We're not kicking anyone off Medicaid that's on it today." What's going to happen there?
Well, this was a subject of a lot of discussion among Republicans, among the governors who've expanded Medicaid, and basically where they ended up, at least for now, is that the Medicaid expansion would go on for two more years until the beginning of 2020. People who were on it then could continue to get it, but no new people in the expansion group, and these are people who are basically not pregnant, not disabled, not children, not elderly. The people who were allowed on under the ACA, those people could continue to get it, but nobody new could could stay on, and eventually that the extra money the federal government is giving would go away. There's a bigger piece of Medicaid that they would also change, and that would be to limit how much federal government would provide to states, and that would be a very large change. Medicaid has always been open-ended, and that's what a lot of the people who are complaining about the Medicaid cuts are pointing to.
Julie, just briefly, what about some things in there that were not related to health care directly, like the rule that chain restaurants post the calorie count of meals on their menus?
Well, those were related to healthcare. They were related to public health. But
right.
But again, these are things that that probably can't be touched in this bill because of the special budget rules. Mm. So they could never have repealed the entire law because otherwise it would be subject to a filibuster in the Senate.
That's Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Julie, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, another story we're following in Washington today. Get used to hearing about Vault 7. That's the code name for thousands of documents released by WikiLeaks, which appear to show how CIA spies hack into phones, computers, and other devices. NPR's Greg Myrie has been digging into these documents released just a few hours ago. So, Greg, we know it's early days, but how would you characterize the importance here and what you're seeing?
Well, it's potentially a very big deal. I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves at this point, but given WikiLeaks' track record, the 2013 dump by Edward Snowden and the 2010 diplomatic cables, it could be similar, something along those lines. These are the cyber hacking tools the CIA uses, according to WikiLeaks.
It's like their toolbox. And security expert Jake Williams told CBS News, "It wouldn't surprise me that there are people changing careers and ending careers as we speak." Bob Ayers, who's a retired intelligence official, said this is very bad, real bad is what he says, for the agency. Why? Tell us more about what we're seeing.
Well, the CIA has spent years working on these tools. It's really an outgrowth of the 2001 attacks, the September 11 attacks, and the CIA began developing all these cyber capabilities. WikiLeaks described this as the CIA's own NSA that it's developed, a sort of a fifth department that does this kind of thing. They could hack into virtually any cell phone, computer,
smart TVs. Yeah,
smart TVs again is something that's come up here. In particular, one item that's getting a lot of attention is apparently codenamed Weeping Angel, which is where a Samsung smart TV is apparently turned off, or the user thinks it's turned off, but in fact it could be still turned on and used as a listening device.
So is this, just let's be clear, is this exposing illegal tools that are being used by the CIA?
No, there's no mention of that any of this would be illegal. It's the kind of thing the CIA and the NSA do, which is eavesdrop. Mm-hmm. So no, there's no indication that it's illegal.
Yeah, and what about the danger, the security of these papers being leaked? Do they reveal maybe software code so that hackers around the world could copy and also start tapping into phones and televisions?
At this point, no. It's just a description of some of these programs and an overview, in a sense. But WikiLeaks says they do have the code, and it involves millions and millions of lines of code that were leaked to it. And there's sort of two things. First of all, potential targets could understand how they might be targeted, number one. And if somebody else were to get this code, they could use it in the way that the CIA intended to use it.
We'd think the CIA, of all people, would be able to keep this secret. But obviously, or maybe not obviously, I mean, how do you think WikiLeaks got it? They say the source that gave it to them wants policy questions that this brings up to be seriously debated. So do we have any idea how it got to WikiLeaks?
We do, according to WikiLeaks. They said this information seemed to be circulating among people who try to hack the U.S. government and some former contractors. And that immediately sets off some alarm bells. Edward Snowden was a contractor at the NSA. So there is this sense that there is this army of contractors out there who might come and go at agencies like this, may have access to classified information, could potentially steal it and then spread it.
And why would people, as we are hearing intelligence experts say, why would people be changing careers, or why would it end somebody's career that this is out?
Well, if they found out how it leaked out, if there was some sort of sloppiness about, how this got out and how somebody leaked it. I mean, these are the CIA's most important tools these days.
Right. Well, look, WikiLeaks published the hacked documents that Russian intelligence services stole from the Democrats during the campaign. Of course, President Trump is claiming without evidence that President Obama was wiretapping him. How do you think, if at all, this data dump will add to the political concerns right now?
It's going to make it even more confusing and complicated. And again, just to point out, President Trump and his team were quite pleased when Democratic emails were being leaked out a few months ago. I think they're going to find it very different as they see CIA secrets potentially being revealed.
Their CIA at this
exactly.
point.
Exactly. Now it's his CIA.
Yeah. Yes. NPR's Greg Myrie on a data dump from WikiLeaks today. Over 8,000 documents. A web page is posted. WikiLeaks promising more, which could make this the group's largest data dump ever, documents stolen and taken from the CIA. Greg, I know you'll be following this story on NPR all day. Thank you.
We will. Thank you.
There are two new reports out today on race and wrongful convictions. One of the headlines is that there were a record number of exonerations last year. The other is that innocent African Americans were more likely to be wrongfully convicted than whites, and that they spend longer in prison before exoneration than whites do. The National Registry of Exonerations compiled the data. And joining us now, the author, University of Michigan law professor Samuel Gross. He's also senior editor of the National Registry of Exonerations. And we're also joined by Obi Anthony, founder and president of Exonerated Nation, a group that helps people who have been exonerated. And he spent 17 years in prison for a murder he didn't commit. He was exonerated in 2011. Welcome to both of you. And Professor Gross, let me start with you. There are two things going on here. Start with, why are exonerations hitting record numbers?
I think the reason is basically that we're looking more. We're spending more time investigating cases in which people were convicted of crimes, and now there's new evidence of innocence. There are more innocence projects that are doing this each year. There are more resources devoted to it by other defense attorneys. And especially in the past 10 years, there are an increasing number of conviction integrity units. These are units in prosecutorial offices that are devoted to identifying and, to the extent possible, correcting cases where innocent people were convicted. That said, 166 exonerations a year, even 500 exonerations a year, in a country where there are about 1 million felony convictions every year, and probably thousands, possibly tens of thousands of convictions of innocent people every year, is still a drop in the bucket. And it remains to be seen whether we'll undertake reforms and attempts to address this problem that are commensurate with the size of the problem.
Now, you haven't said three letters that I would have thought I would hear by now on this issue, and that's DNA. Has that been a big part of the number of exonerations?
It's a part. In fact, I'm not surprised that you expected to hear them. I think most Americans think that exoneration is the second word of a two-word phrase that begins with the letters DNA. Mm. DNA exonerations have always been a minority of the exonerations. And the reason is pretty straightforward. DNA is extremely useful in cases in which the criminal leaves some type of biological trace evidence, in rape cases where it's most often used, semen, that can identify the person who committed the crime. But that's not true in most crimes. It's not true in robberies. It's not true in drug crimes. It's not true. So where DNA is available, it's extremely valuable. Also, a lot of the cases where DNA could clear people who were imprisoned years ago before DNA testing was available before trial have been cleared. And a lot of the others are now getting old or have died or are out of prison for other reasons. So the number of cases where DNA will be available for the types of purposes that it used to exonerate people for, ordinary routine sexual assault cases, will decrease over time. That'll be done before trial, or it will have already been done.
And what about the issue that you bring up in the other report, which is that innocent African Americans are more likely to be wrongfully convicted than whites? What's the main reason for that?
The reason is well known. Everybody is better at identifying strangers of their own race than identifying strangers of other races. And that's especially true of whites in this society than as compared to African Americans, because whites like myself are a majority. So we may spend our entire life with relatively little contact with African Americans and therefore not be able to distinguish African Americans from each other. But African Americans, by necessity, have to deal with whites all the time because we're the great majority in the country. That's a well-known problem, and it explains why a very small sliver of the rape crimes that are committed in the United States, crimes in which black men attack white women, account for 50% of the exonerations in which eyewitness identification was an issue.
Well, Obi Anthony, let me bring you in. You are African American, and you say race played a role in your case, but there were other problems with your case. It started on March 27th, 1994, when a man was shot and killed outside an apartment building in Los Angeles, and a resident of the building identified you as one of the shooters. And then after you were convicted, a judge determined that he lied during his testimony and prosecutors failed to disclose that they had made a deal with him in exchange for his testimony against you.
Yes, correct. And this resident, I mean, like, let's truth be told, he was a pimp that was running a brothel. The building in which the crime happened outside of was a known brothel. The Los Angeles Police Department, Newton, they were all familiar and was aware of the brothel being ran. And the individual who pointed towards me and my ex co-defendant, as I say now, he was an individual who ran the brothel. And so, he was already fishy from the gate. This is information in which I wasn't privileged to until later on after my conviction. So,
and why were you exonerated?
Well, I got exonerated because of the judge found that there was prosecutorial misconduct, that there was police misconduct, that there was ineffective assistance of counsel, and that ultimately was a miscarriage of justice.
So 17 years for you in prison for a crime that you didn't commit. What has it been like to try to rebuild your life since you got out?
It's been like, for lack of better metaphors, it's been like a salmon kind of going upstream, trying to, all kind of different obstacles, technology. Initially trying to find a job, also trying to get my identification when I first came home, also trying to find some help with my PTSD when I came home. There was no services that was in line for me when I came home. It wasn't like I was convicted of a crime, so I didn't have the privileges of the parole board. And so after all of those years and after me coming home, only thing was given to me was someone else's clothes and the door open for me to walk out into a society that which I had no a lot of information I didn't have.
And the PTSD, and so, by the way, just from being in prison, you mean?
Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, I talk about it a lot. I get a chance to go around and talk to kids at different universities and colleges, and I explain to them that, for 17 years of my life, I had to get up for breakfast and go to a chow hall. And every time I walked out of that door, I had to be concerned whether or not if my neighbor or a guy down the tier was going to try to assault me or stab me. And that was my going to breakfast and going to dinner every day whenever I came out of the cell. And I asked them, did you think about some harm happened to you when you got out of your bed to go down to the kitchen to get something to eat? And it's that sort of trauma, that sort of stress that's on a person's mind every single day of self-preservation. How do I keep myself safe and secure in here, knowing that I'm innocent and I'm surrounded by all of these different type of individuals, from manipulators to connivers and lie, all of these individuals who seek to try to do harm to those individuals who they see weakness in. And it was a difficult environment.
Did you ever, in the course of those 17 years, wonder if you actually had committed the crime? In other words, does your mind play tricks on you and you start to think, well, maybe I did do this if I've been put in this position?
Absolutely not. I mean, I talk to the kids about that. It's like, when you're at home and you have a sibling at the house and your sibling do something and mom comes home and, perceives or believes that it's you and immediately begins to start launching off on you and the sibling sits back and doesn't do anything. You don't take it. No, you don't.
Right.
You never think that, wander in your mind. Only thing running around in your mind is when is the truth going to come out. The fact of it is that you realize and understand and appreciate that they can do whatever you want to the truth and it'll come out at some time or another. And that's what happened in this case here. The truth came out. it took 17 years and a happenstance of some other situation to bring forth that truth. But the fact of it is that it was uncovered and I was able to get my freedom.
So, Professor Gross, let me go back to you. When you hear that story from Obi Anthony, are there policy changes that could be made at this point based on your reports that could stop these situations from happening where people end up spending years in prison for crimes they didn't commit?
Definitely. The first policy reform would be for the police to do what they're supposed to and not cut corners, not deal with cases as casually as they sometimes do, and especially not do that in a manner that discriminates on the basis of race.
It has to do with white privilege. Until individuals begin to start recognizing that there is a white privilege that is attached to not only to the criminal justice system, but how it operates and how it treats those not only guilty, but those who are innocent as well, the people as a whole. And the fact of it is that when we recognize that there is a privilege that is attached to those individuals and how they utilize it and how they exact their authority upon individuals such as myself and other individuals is erroneous. And we need to not only take light of it and make awareness of it, but we need to be assertive and take action. You have exonerees who go around and advocate for reform. I myself advocate for reform. There's a law in the state of California called Obie's Law because of my advocation. Also in the state of California, because of my advocacy work, there's a law that was put in place to hold prosecutors accountable who knowingly and willfully withhold evidence against the innocent. And it's a felony in the state of California because of that.
Well, we will link to the reports at hereandnow.org. Obi Anthony, founder and president of Exonerated Nation, and Samuel Gross, who is the senior editor of the National Registry of Exonerations. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson, and I want you to take a minute right now to think about the people you love. Have they ever listened to a podcast? Do they even know podcasts exist? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media. And if they don't know how to download a podcast, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a whole new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag TryPod. That's hashtag TryPod. And thanks.
The Commerce Department reported today that the U.S. trade deficit has reached levels not seen in nearly 5 years, rising almost 10% in January to $48.5 billion. Of course, President Trump has made a pledge to reduce the deficit. Well, he's got a bigger challenge now. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joins us from New York. And Jason, you know, the question is whether or not we should work so hard to reduce that trade deficit. But first, let's explain trade deficit. We buy more from other countries. They buy from us. We import more than we export. What are we buying more and exporting less of to bring this jump between January and December?
Hi, Robin. Well, you summed it up well. In terms of what we're buying more of, it's mostly capital goods. We're talking about semiconductors, cell phones, automobiles, and oil. In fact, January's imports of cars and parts was the highest on record. Also, crude oil prices are up again, the highest since they've been since August, and our imports the highest since July of 2013. All of those things contributing. And then the other factor here is that we've had stronger growth here in the United States and stronger growth abroad. So there's more trade in general happening. And with a firmer dollar and the dollar rising, imports have gotten cheaper in the U.S. and our exports to other countries more expensive.
Well, in particular because they have tariffs and things that they put on them. So let's get to the debate, because it seems to be, as Donald Trump says, the deficit is bad for jobs because we're buying things from elsewhere, and that means our factories are closing. White House trade advisor Peter Navarro wrote in The Wall Street Journal this week, reducing the trade deficit will boost economic growth. But then you have economists like Michael Klein from Tufts. He says Trump has it all wrong. A trade deficit is an indicator of strength. So flesh out that debate.
Lord, yeah, lots of different viewpoints on this. And economists are warning against the assumption that simply cutting the trade deficits is going to boost growth in the U.S. Now, the argument that Mr. Navarro is making is that, and I'll quote him here, he says, you can't buy an air conditioner, much less pay your mortgage if you get laid off because your job went offshore. Mm-hmm. So they're drawing a direct connection between this trade deficit and the idea that more manufacturing jobs need to come to the United States. And they're also pointing out, the administration's pointing out, that you know we do have a surplus when it comes to the service industry, but those are often low-paying jobs. So the administration's emphasis is we need to have more types of – more manufacturing and be just exporting more goods and making, as Trump keeps saying again and again, fair, you know, better deals with our trade partners.
Well, we know people who are kind of pointing to the trade deficit as something that isn't as big a problem say that it's basically other countries lending the U.S. money because we get things so inexpensively. And as to jobs, people should focus on maybe figuring out what are better jobs than the ones that have gone overseas. Meanwhile, what do you see? What do you see happening here? Just got a few seconds.
It's a really tough problem to fix. I mean, we haven't had an annual surplus since the mid-1970s. Last year, the gap reached over $500 billion. It's not going to be an overnight fix. And you know what? Our trade imbalance with China is over $309 billion.
Okay.
And trade war, you want to get a trade war, then you might be able to fix that, but it could be very dangerous.
Right. Well, we're going to pick this up continuously, looking at the trade deficit and what's to be done. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal, thanks for starting us off.
You bet. Thank you.
Reaction is coming in from around the world to President Trump's revised travel ban. Iran has said it plans to go forward with banning Americans from getting visas to that country, which is one of six majority Muslim countries covered by the new ban. The others are Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. The latest order does not include Iraq. And that's where NPR's Jane Arraf is now, in the northern city of Sulaymaniyah. Jane, what are you hearing? How are people there reacting to the revised ban?
Well, Jeremy, here in Iraq, there is a lot of relief, obviously, because they've dropped Iraq from that list of people who are banned. And this was threatening to be a really serious crisis here with the Iraqi government and with Parliament, which had threatened to impose its own ban on American visas. So in announcing the new ban, the administration said it had dropped Iraq from the list because of new commitments from the Iraqi government and because Iraq actually is fighting ISIS along with the U.S. But maybe the biggest effect from this ban is on Syrians, and specifically on Syrian refugees. So as you know, Jeremy, the new order halts refugee arrivals for 30 days into the U.S., and after that it cuts the entire refugee program in half.
Hmm. So you spoke to some of those Syrian refugees. What did they have to say?
Well, I went out to the Jordanian city of Zarqa, which is the second biggest city in Jordan, and I met Rahab Ajwad and her husband, Firas al-Maqdad. They had left Syria 4 years ago because their house was destroyed by airstrikes. Firas has a law degree, but he's been working as a barber, working very carefully as a barber because it's illegal for most Syrian refugees to work there, so he's always afraid of being arrested. And Rabab was supposed to go with her husband and her 4-year-old son to the States, to Texas, where her mom and dad and the rest of her family is. But she was pregnant at the time. So she now has 8-month-old twins, and she doesn't know when she's going to get to see her parents. She was incredibly distraught when I saw her. She said they were so happy about the thought that they would all be reunited again, but they're losing hope. And as for Firas, he wanted to tell us about the town that he comes from. It's a town called Busra Sham, where there's an international music festival every year. And he says foreigners come there and they open their homes to them. They have them stay there. They don't charge them. He said people have entirely the wrong idea about Syria. And then he went on to say that what Americans and other people need to understand is that Syrians are peaceful people, and given half a chance, if there were peace again in their country, they would go back immediately.
How is her family in the U.S. reacting to the ban?
Well, I spoke to her father, Ajwad, who is in Houston, Texas. He's been there for a year or so now. And he says things are great. He's working as a machine operator in a cheesecake factory. But he was also quite distraught that he hasn't seen his grandchildren, these children who were born 8 months ago. They're twins. He said, too, that he thought people didn't understand why Syrians were leaving. They weren't leaving to cause trouble. They weren't leaving to engage in violence. He said if they didn't mind violence, they would have stayed in Syria.
Now, Jane, this has been a confusing time at the U.S. border with some people being questioned or detained. Is that happening at foreign borders because of the travel ban? Of course, we know that it doesn't go into effect until March 16th, but are we expecting more people being detained overseas?
So the last time this happened, it was absolute chaos because, as we all remember, I think there was really no notice. So I was at airports there and people didn't know what to do. They were trying to rush to the U.S. to use their visas. Some were actually turned back despite having valid visas. Now, this time, as you point out, there is a little bit of time for it to kick in. But people who have visas, who got them before the time limit that's specified in this new travel ban, are actually rushing to use them. In the meantime, people like Rahab and her husband are kind of typical of what's happening with a lot of other families. This ban has had the effect of separating families, some of them in the United States, some of them still waiting to go back to be reunited with their families.
That's NPR's Jane Arraf joining us from Sulaymaniyah in Iraq. Jane, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, last month, when White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer outlined the administration's new executive orders on immigration, he said President Trump wanted to empower immigration agents to more fully do their jobs.
The president wanted to take the shackles off individuals in these agencies and say, you have a mission. There are laws that need to be followed. You should do your mission and follow the law.
Well, ICE agents, as they're known, have always had a certain amount of discretion. The question is how that discretion will play out now. Shannon Dooling from Here and Now contributor WBUR reports.
At a sports bar in Randolph, Massachusetts, the TV in the corner is tuned to Fox News, and there's a White House press briefing on. Sports dominate every other screen, and a steady stream of 90s pop hits plays in the background. This is where Albert Orlowski and I agreed to meet to talk about his career as an ICE agent.
Over 25 years of federal law enforcement, 21 in immigration, ICE.
Just the term ICE evokes emotion. Three letters emblazoned on the back of a dark jacket and nondescript white vans. They're images synonymous with fear for many people in the country illegally. ICE agents seek out so-called targets and often use the element of surprise. I ask Orlowski, what's it like to enter a home searching for someone you could play a role in deporting?
Well, you act professional. Of course, you try to be as humane as possible. I would try to avoid any situation where I knew there was a child in the house. I would wait. It's the last thing I wanted to do, traumatize a young kid.
Orlowski says he had 100% discretion as an agent, and his mentality was get in, get your target, and get out. But he says that's certainly not the case for every agent.
Usually one agent, one officer who's in charge of the operation. We basically do what he tells us to do. Like I say, when I was in charge, I made it perfectly clear. We go in and get what we came for and leave. Other people like to interview other candidates.
Orlowski tells a story of accompanying a younger agent. Once they were in the target's house, the younger agent wanted to interview other people in the room he suspected were in the country illegally. But Orlowski and his partner were outnumbered, and tempers were running high.
We stood in there too long, and the thing almost got out of hand. It got to the point where, like, we were surrounded. Now what do you do? That's why I learned my lesson. I only get burned once.
In the end, Orlowski says only the target subjects were apprehended. Listening to the 59-year-old retired Orlowski speak about his experiences as an ICE agent reveals some interesting dynamics. At times, he laughs, recalling stories about far-flung assignments. Other times, he answers a complicated legal question with a dry accuracy that only comes from working in the field for 20 years. At other points, he stares off, talking about young children clutching his leg, crying and begging him not to take their family. He stiffens a bit when speaking into the microphone, explaining how he believes ICE agents will respond to Trump's new priorities for deportation.
I think they'll be a lot more aggressive now due to the fact that there's more people in the pool to apprehend, more potential candidates out there.
Has their job changed at the most basic level?
No, still the same job. The only thing is right now they're actually enforcing the laws they were sworn to enforce instead of just not enforcing the laws.
Trump's executive orders on immigration have brought renewed focus on the role of ICE agents like Orlowski. Depending on how you read the guidance from Department of Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly, you could say that instead of broadening the priorities for deportation, the executive order essentially strips them away, making almost any non-citizen vulnerable for deportation. Former Boston Immigration Court Judge Eliza Klein says ICE agents have always had a certain amount of discretion in the field, and that doesn't necessarily change with these new priorities.
You have some ICE officers who are like, I want to enforce this the way it's written. And then you have others who are like, you know, man, I mean, I don't want to see these family members suffer. So there will be some individual determinations.
Sarah Sherman-Stokes at Boston University's Immigrants' Rights Clinic says uneven enforcement from community to community and more aggressive ICE agents terrifies many immigrants.
Because there is a sort of unpredictability, or maybe better put, the only thing that's predictable is a heightened degree of aggressive enforcement, then the impact is fear.
Fear of going to the doctor, fear of going to school, and fear of going to work, she says. Asked about how the new guidelines affect an ICE agent's day-to-day duties, the Department of Homeland Security declined to comment, saying they would allow the president's executive orders to speak for themselves. For Here and Now, I'm Shannon Dooling.
And a quick note, today the Senate Judiciary Committee questioned the man who would be the second highest official at the Justice Department. Rod Rosenstein has served as U.S. Attorney for Maryland since 2005. He's respected by members of both parties, but he's also just landed in the middle of a controversy. If confirmed as the Deputy Attorney General, he'll be responsible for any department investigation into Russia's meddling in the presidential election, because Attorney General Jeff Sessions has recused himself from that case after failing to disclose that he met with the Russian ambassador. Today, Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy, a Democrat, said the Russian hacking of the Democratic National Committee is just as serious as Watergate, and he asked Rosenstein if he agreed that the investigation of Russia was of extraordinary importance.
Senator, I don't know the details of what, if any, investigation is ongoing, but I can certainly assure you, if it's America against Russia or America against any other country, I think everyone in this room knows which side I'm on.
And, I do too, but would you also agree that American people, if there's such an investigation, they have to have confidence in the integrity of it?
I believe it's critical for the American people to have confidence in the integrity of our investigations, yes.
Well, when asked if a special prosecutor should be appointed to handle the investigation, Rosenstein said he was not in a position to answer that question, but he said he'd be willing to appoint a special counsel whenever he felt it was appropriate. We're going to be keeping an eye on this story as it develops, but what do you think? Should there be a special investigation, or what do you think about anything in politics? Well, you may not want to bring it up at the gym. Just before the election, Southampton Hospital in New York banned political debates in its cardio unit gym for fear patients would have another heart attack. And now the YMCA in Scranton, Pennsylvania, is banning cable news after a political argument almost became a fist fight. Trish Fisher is CEO of the Greater Scranton YMCA. Trish, what happened?
Well, over the past, I would say, 6 months, there has been a few different occasions when members came up to me and said, you know, they're arguing in the men's locker room over the politics, et cetera. And one day a board member came up to me and said that two gentlemen were having heated words and that they needed some help back there because it was just about ready to go physical, which it didn't. But we just don't feel this is the place for that.
Well, so TV's off. Look, I've been hearing about this a lot at home. My friend Lori Hamill owns something called the Longfellow Health Clubs here in Massachusetts, and he had a member quit months ago because they did not have Fox News on their shared big screen TVs. And now he has several members threatening to quit because they do have Fox News. And he's thinking of moving completely to a small TV on every piece of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
But that's expensive. Could you even consider that?
No, not really. I mean, this is specific to the men's locker room because all of our equipment in our main wellness center does have individual earplugs that need to be plugged in to be able to hear the TVs. Mm. This is specific to the men's locker room, and we do have a couple of ideas on how to take care of that because I really don't want to, quote-unquote, punish all the rest of the members because of just a handful or so of men.
So what might you do?
Well, we've tried to lock the channels, and actually they have brought in universal remotes to change them. But I think we're just going to take the cable boxes right out of the room.
Okay, so you are going to keep it banned. Look, Scranton is famously where Joe Biden is from. How would you describe the political climate there? Because the vote was pretty well split in November.
Yeah, I would say that pretty much reflects how people feel around here. It's been pretty quiet since the election.
Well, except apparently at the Y, you know,
in
your gym. Is it different now that you've shut off the cable boxes?
Very different. People are emailing me, they're calling me, they're meeting me out in our lobby and throughout the Y, just saying this is just such a great idea and saying thank you and I support you and, you know, I wish we could have done this a long time ago. I've had a few express concern about censorship, et cetera, but after I explained to them the reasons, you know, at any point during the day, we have at least 100 children in the building and, you know, we're all about carrying honesty, respect, and responsibility, and our core values, we really have to base everything on that.
Well, I was going to ask you about just that, about, you know, people saying it's their basic right, but it sounds like you're saying that health, no pun intended, trumps that right. These are health clubs, and there's such a thing as mental health,
right,
too. Look, coincidentally, the IHRSA convention starts this Tuesday in Los Angeles. That's the annual convention of all the health club owners. You're the Y nonprofit. You wouldn't be there. But have you heard this from other Ys?
Yes. We meet on a monthly basis, our Northeast Pennsylvania Ys, and several of them said that they have had challenges with the 24-hour news channels. And several of them have not allowed these channels for years. Mm-hmm. So it's just one of our members decided to call you guys, call the press.
Wow. Well, what people were feeling is being, you know, acted upon in the YMCAs. Trish Fisher,
yeah,
CEO of the Greater Scranton Y. Thanks so much for speaking with us. And we love the Ys. Thank you for what you do.
Thank you, Robin.
So what does this say about us, Jeremy? I'd love to hear from listeners. Is this a thing? Are people fighting in their gyms? Club owners? If so, how are you solving it? Let us know. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, and I feel like every time I'm at the gym, all the TVs just have pizza commercials on. It's Here and Now.